For NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. We're about to talk to one of our heroes, John Congleton. You may know him, you may not, but chances are his production credit is on a record you love. It might be the newest Angel Olsen record, or the St. Vincent record, or others by Earl Sweatshirt, David Byrne, The Lower Dens, Erykah Badu, The Roots, Bill Callahan, The Mountain Goats, Modest Mouse, The New Pornographers, Swans, the list goes on. John Congleton is a 37-year-old musician, producer, and engineer with a passion for bringing out the best in artists he works with. My conversation with him and Robin Hilton is as much a geeky look at what a producer does as it is a philosophical look at life and appreciating sound.
I have this mantra, and it all kind of comes from John Peel, who's kind of one of my heroes.
Yeah.
Because I feel like...
And for those who don't know John Peel, in the 1960s and 70s and more, he was this radio figure that just culled and mined the best music there was. His taste was
the kingmaker.
Right. He really, really is a monster.
I mean, everybody from Jimi Hendrix to This Heat, you know, he showed to the UK, essentially. Anyways, I've always felt like if there's anybody who had the right to be cynical or burned out or anything, it would be John Peel. And just a few years before he died, I read something that he said where he said that anytime he ever hears a piece of music that he doesn't like, he just assumes it's his problem, which I think is so great.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, somebody spent the money, spent the time, they put everything they had into this. No matter how bad he thinks it is, it's just a bummer for him that he can't enjoy it. And I think that's really brave to feel that way.
It is. That's a great way to look at it.
And so I basically, every day of my life, I think about that. Whenever somebody sends me music, I listen to everything that comes to me, you know? Like, I always... It's far more challenging to try to find something that you like about something than to just cast it aside. And I feel like that's... Maybe it's... We're saturated with a lot of music
right
now, of course. But, I mean, it's such a cynical world in art critique right now. And I really appreciate that you guys... come from a place of positivity. I really appreciate that.
Thanks. I used to listen to everything I get. Now, I'd say that we probably get 300 releases weekly, so it's not possible. So you have to, like, figure out what it is you're going to choose to listen to, and some of that is by cover art. Some of that is by title. Some of that is by who sent it to you. Some of that is by... You have to somehow get to the point that there aren't enough hours in the week. But I always remember when I first started doing this, it always felt like I thought, okay, this person may well have spent their grandmother's inheritance on this record.
That's right.
Right? It's just what John Peel is saying. People are putting their blood and sweat in this record. And it's one thing to decide that you don't want to spend the time telling people, telling the world, or telling your fans or whatever about a record. But it's another thing to then, like, go out on a limb and spend your time being pissy about it.
I kind of don't understand it. It's just a shame if you can't appreciate it. I mean, like, you get to miss out on something that some people are, you know, think is cool. That's too bad.
Yeah, whenever Bob doesn't like something I pick, I always assume it's his fault.
It is. Yeah. It is.
It's his own failing. How does that tie into your own work as a producer? You know, do you ever get sent something, you know, for consideration to work on or work with, and you're thinking, your immediate reaction is, well, I'm not really getting this, but maybe there's something I'm missing, and you decide to work with it?
If I don't like something immediately, it makes me angry at myself a little bit. Like, and so I kind of feel committed to, like, okay, what is it about this that's challenging me? Because art that doesn't challenge you is not interesting to me. So I'm actually normally a little more intoxicated by the stuff that I don't understand. Because at the end of the day, if I get something out of that, I'm a better producer, I'm a better listener, I'm a better everything, you know. I've gotten to work with a lot of my heroes already and a lot of bands that I really love. One of the things I do now is I just try to find things that actually maybe I feel like I can be helpful with. And sometimes it's music that's great, but it's already great. They don't need me around.
Do you remember the first time you picked up an instrument and started making music, having heard, I'm sure, plenty of music? What age would that have been?
Probably pretty young. My father is a huge music fan and still, I mean, was then and still is, and he played music, and he was involved in the whole, like, Texas 60s psychedelic thing. You know?
In what way?
He played drums in a band called The Torsions, and they were cousins to the Mystics, and Mystics were cousins to the 13-floor Elevators and Moving Sidewalks and all this really, really, really great forward-thinking music. My father loves music, and music was always on, always, always, always. And it was usually pretty obtuse and, you know, subversive rock and roll, frankly. My dad, being kind of a normal guy, he has great weird taste in music, actually. And his favorite band was ZZ Top. And the first five ZZ Top records, I still think, have informed, like, what I think is a good band. You know?
I had no idea it was going to go
that way.
That
was not where I thought you were going.
Oh, I love ZZ Top so much. I mean, like, the first five records are incredible to me. But to answer your question, there was always musical instruments around. Mm-hmm. I started, like, I wanted to be a drummer really badly, but I think my dad... Either he didn't want the noise around, or maybe he was jealous of the idea of me playing drums, too. So he played drums. Yeah.
Well, he didn't need another drummer.
Exactly. Yeah.
He needed a guitar.
We really need
player.
A bassist.
Let's get real here.
Yeah. Well, my sister played bass, so, I gravitated to the guitar.
Totally makes sense. I applaud your father.
Yeah, right.
And so making music, starting to make music after hearing so much music, what was the attraction? Was the attraction being able to do something that you heard? Was the attraction... creating something that you could imagine? You know, when you first start playing, what do you dig into? What is?
Well, I was an awkward kid.
How do you mean that?
I was a, you know, late bloomer.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't
geeky?
Hit my... Very geeky, into comic books, into horror movies, which I'm still into those things. But, you know, growing up in Texas, you either played football or you know, or you drove a truck.
You're
or
a slighter build than most football
exactly,
players.
Exactly, yeah. Have. I'm a Keebler elf. And, you know, so, I mean, I think possibly at the beginning, I just wanted to be able to do something that made me feel like I could communicate something, because I felt very misunderstood in general. And I don't know. I guess I just wanted something that was my own, honestly. And I think that that's why originally I was attracted to it.
Did you and your dad and your sister ever play together?
Never. It's never happened. I have played with my sister.
All right.
How is that possible?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have played with my sister, though.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow.
No, we've never actually done that, but if this part ends up on the radio, then maybe it'll happen.
You're going to get a call.
One of the when my son was born, Robin now has a new son. When my son was born, I played electronic music, and I thought, I'm going to play music with my kids somehow, I hope.
Uh-huh.
I hope. Uh-huh. And I bought a 12-string guitar from somebody for $50. And as he grew up, he wanted to play in fiddle, and we started playing music together.
That's excellent.
And it really is quite a lovely thing. Your dad needs to experience that, so get on it.
I think he recently, I don't think he has a trap kit anymore. He has an electronic drum kit, which is
so
adorable
much,
to watch
say,
him
so
play.
I've got it. As sort of a gateway to get you guys, you know, comfortable playing, ZZ Top cover band.
Hey, I have zero problem with that. I can play all those early songs.
Yeah.
I love that. When you were starting to get into music and stuff, well, first of all, what age would that have been that you picked up the instruments and stuff?
I fiddled around, of course, but I didn't actually start playing until about 14, and by 15 I already had a band and was barely could play, but I was going to write songs.
Got to know the name, the band's name.
Well, I was in a lot of other bands. I was in a lot of bands. The first band was called Curb Job.
It's always a great name. First band name is always the good name.
Which, it Google Curb Job if you don't know what that is.
Hang on a minute.
All I'm thinking of is Curb Stomp, but that's very, very different.
Well, it might be exactly the same thing. It's something that the mafia would do to people.
That's curb stomping.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, not pleasant.
Wow.
And the music sounded exactly like that, believe me. Whatever you're imagining, it was that, but worse.
Did you have any idea when you got started what a producer did?
No idea at all. I had no interest at all.
I mean, just you saw liner notes and you saw this. Did you have any concept of what they did?
Zero. I was obsessed with the way records sounded. But that's what drew me to engineering. Producing, becoming a producer, happened completely organically. Like, that happened by virtue of just people starting to ask me to produce and, you know, after engineering records for a while. So I feel like I came to production in a pretty honest way. You know, anybody that kicks down the door and says that, hey, I'm a producer, you should maybe be suspect of, you know.
Can you remember hearing a record and wondering how the heck it was made and then digging into it and learning about the different roles and stuff like that? And do we have a song we can sort of play
for
someone first?
Yeah, for sure. I think that the song that would be the Ronettes song, Be My Baby.
Okay. Why don't we play some of that? Because a distinctive sound, if ever there was one.
Yeah, for sure.
Imagine what captured you about that song.
I mean, yeah, what, it's pretty bland sounding, really, honestly. Not memorable in the slightest.
Yeah. When that popped out of my little transistor radio, those little tiny 2-inch, 1.5-inch speaker, it sounded huge. And of course, all of us have much better stereos than that. So tell me about what it was that hit your ears besides the Department of the Obvious here.
Well,
or talk about the Department of the Obvious, this amazing song produced by Phil Spector in 1963, summer 63.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't the music of my parents, you know. Like I was talking about my father. He was into rock and roll and the Kinks and stuff like that.
And you heard this at what age? When?
Oh, so young, you know. It was just on the oldies record, you know, station or whatever.
And you roughly how old, maybe?
Oh, I would say probably 4.
Wow.
I mean, definitely one of the first memories I have. And I mean, it sounds like it's being beamed in from another planet. It's such a holistic, solid sound and so committed to what it is. And
that's a great way to put it. I like that.
It's just all the way there, right? It's 11. It's on 11. And any song that you can identify in less than 10 milliseconds by the bass drum sound, that's a complete production success. The only other song I can think about like that would be Billie Jean, Quincy Jones, and Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you can accomplish that, everybody knows Be My Baby by the bass drum. I can't remember who said this to me or where I heard this, but like somebody said that pop music was the power of now, the moment of now. And I feel like that song nails that. Like, because every time that song comes on, time just melts away. I'm just, for that less than 3 minutes, I'm in that song, and it never lets me go, you know?
Never let me go.
Yeah.
Did you understand, not at 4, but did you come to understand what the producer of that song, what Phil Spector did to make the sound of that record?
Not specifically, but I think that anybody that listens to that knows that there was somebody crafting that, you know. I think if there is an algorithm to successful production, which there isn't, this is ridiculous, but as a thought experiment, if there was an algorithm, it would be having as many moments as possible, like a special moment. And that song is just a moment. The entire song is a moment.
Is that something the producer can do, or is that something that the songwriter has to bring to the table to begin with? You know, like when you were working on the new St. Vincent record, the self-titled St. Vincent record, was that something, when you listened to the songs that she brought to the studio, was that something that you had in mind?
I think that for a record to be successful, every cylinder has to be firing. When you're talking about me and Annie, I think that both of us have a tremendous amount of trust in one another. I think she's so great. And I love to let her thrive, and she really likes to let me thrive, and we just trust each other a lot. So I think we already both knew that there needed to be moments, you know? And mm-hmm. so she would trust me to the point of where I could capture those moments, and I would trust her to lead the songs in whatever way she thought.
So let's go ahead and let's play a cut off of the St. Vincent record. Let's play Digital Witness, and we'll talk about how what she brought to the table, what you brought to the table.
Good to you.
She didn't just bring one song to the table in that song. There are like four songs in that song.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the way her brain
her
works?
Her little brain. No. Sure, her wonderful
bitty
brain.
Bitty little.
No, her wonderful brain.
Yeah, of course.
As manic as that song sounds, that actually I kind of tend to remember being sort of the idea when she sent it to me as a demo. On the record before, there was a bunch of like disparate ideas all over the place, and we kind of put them together. Like the single off the last record, Cruel, was actually, I think, three different ideas. Then just like, here, let's just try these three ideas together. And it actually worked out. Sometimes, normally, that doesn't work out. But songwriting wise, that song is completely her. That's just right out of her brain, honestly. As far as what I might have brought to that song, I think it would have been the rhythm section and the propulsion and that sort of
what
like
what was
groove.
The rhythm section? What was the propulsion?
So that's Homer from the Dap Kings playing drums, and he's a tremendous, great drummer. And the bass that you're hearing there is a guy that I've known for years named Bobby Sparks. Incredible like Moog synthesizer player with just really, really great like R&B feel.
So that wasn't a regular, that was
no,
all electronic
that's
bass.
That's a Moog bass, which is primarily the bass sound on that record.
The horn parts shared a lot of similarities to the David Byrne Love This Giant, which you also worked on.
Yeah. There was quite a bit of talk about that, of like, did it sound too much like something off that record?
You mean when you guys were in the studio?
When we were in the studio, you know. Actually, who's playing horns on that is Ralph Carney, who plays for Tom Waits. What her and I did in the studio together with that song is never make anything too obvious. You know, like if you notice the way she sings the melody, get back. Well, we endlessly were referencing the B-52s on that record. Huh. And I think, well, how would the B-52s sing that? And they would make it this ridiculous differential between the notes. She would, you know, so if you listen, it's bop. You know, just like a ridiculous, jagged, and so it's like,
would have thought of that.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, is it Fred Schneider? doing the
Tate.
Hey, now,
we would actually sing along like Fred Schneider to that song, and like
completely going to change the next time I listen to this record.
Well, we love B-52s. Yeah, the first couple records we were referencing a lot, guitar wise, rhythm section wise, everything.
Ricky Wilson. I'm trying to think of the guitar player.
Oh, he's such a tremendous guitar player. Yeah.
You're working on your own record right now, a solo record, and Bob and I were listening to some of the cuts from it. It wasn't hard for us to hear some of the sonic connections that tie your own solo work to what we just heard from Annie Clark from St. Vincent. And can we play one of the cuts, one of your cuts from the record you're working on? This is called Until the Horror Goes.
Teeth peppered in the bramble leaves, and my Latin jaw and my bourgeois drawl and my embossed flashing belt. Let's turn the weapons on ourselves. They found a running table saw with a blood trail leading off to a list of demons I held close, and they are legion, not grown tales. Let's turn the weapons on ourselves. And you turn on your heels. My pride, my flashing pride. Oh, you wanna know how hard I'm trying to keep you mine from drapely clothes. Every handsome robe I know you love on more. My pride, how do I silence this restlessness inside me? This chaos that's residing.
John, this is, first of all, this is it all you or some of you or...
It's me.
All, everything.
Let me think.
Yeah.
No, it's a couple friends playing with me on some of the stuff,
It sounds like, it reminds me of the spirit in the band Fun. I hope that...
I actually haven't heard much of that.
Okay, yeah. There's a big smile in their music all the time. And that's what I feel. And I love that there's this, I assume it's an analog synth, but this crazy kind of siren-y synth that just runs
theremin.
Through the whole theremin. Is that a theremin?
It's a theremin, yeah.
It really certainly has that manic energy. And of course, Bob would pick a song called Until the Horror Goes and say, I really feel a smile in there.
Oh, well, wait. Let's talk about that for a second because everything, all the music that I do is extremely wry and sardonic. It's just the way I've always been lyrically. And like everything that I'm saying is very heartfelt and very important, but also kind of a little bit there like, huh, this is all ridiculous. And, you know, like all these emotions, you know, like it's all pretty ridiculous, you know. So that's what gets me through life. It's like teetering between like sort of being depressed and not depressed. What I've found is the difference between being depressed and not depressed is I hold the same truths, but when I'm not depressed, I just find it all funny. But when I cease to find it funny, that's when I'm depressed. And so I never actually change the way I feel about anything in regards to the universe. It's just how funny I think it is. So that's where that sort of sense of humor is that you might be hearing. And as Woody Allen says, and I kind of think about this almost every day, we all hold the same truths. Our lives consist on how we choose to distort those truths.
Perfect. That sounds like a philosophy of yours.
That is. I always say that also perception is 9/10 of reality, which is there are these theories that there are really only two states within a human being, and that is a state of rest or a state of activity. And horror is no different. That state of activity is no different than humor is as a state of activity. It's just how you're perceiving it. It's like your body feels is actually feeling physically exactly the same in both cases. It's active, but you're just looking at it differently.
Right. I mean, and not to force a segue or anything like that, but like what you're hearing in my music there, like I can directly tie into like Pink Floyd or like The Wall.
I think
or
we need to
like
because
that.
I was so happy to see this on your list.
Mother?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I should just say that in general, The Wall, just in general, as a record.
More than any other Pink Floyd record?
The Wall, The Final Cut, and Dark Side of the Moon. Those are all at the same level, but mm-hmm. I chose The Wall because it was so ridiculously a concept record. And it's just the idea of a concept record. This record was the record that told me that concept records are something I want to do. You know, like I was in a band called The Paper Chase, and every record we did was a concept record. The last record we did, every song was written about a natural disaster and sort of like drawing some sort of parallel between that and the human condition. Now, totally pretentious. I'm completely aware.
Well, but it's a focus point.
But it is. And actually, I got goosebumps when you said that it made you, when you heard The Wall, it made you realize that this is concept records, that mm-hmm. that's something you wanted to do. I was 10 or 11 when it came out. And I remember a friend explaining to me the story that's mm-hmm. being told. And when he told me that, and I started listening to the story unfold in these songs and all the little tricks and things they had going on that connected the songs together, it blew my mind. Yeah, and it was what, it's like this, it made me see, wow, music can really be something. I mean, you know, other than the pop hits
absolutely.
That I was hearing on the
absolutely
on the radio.
It's a profound record.
Let's listen to Mother. It's one of those slower songs on the,
is there anything production wise in this that we should listen for?
Well, I think that the best thing about this song is just the build. It just takes its time, never rushes anything. And Roger Waters, who I think is a genius, he says these very simple lines, plaintive, and then just lets it sit. And every line to me is communicating something very profound, like, can I be loved? Will you love me? Mm. Like infantile id, really important human emotions. And he just lets it sit there like a bad smell almost, you know, and I just love that.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song? Mother, do you think they'll try to break my balls? Ooh, mother, should I build the wall? Mother, should I run for president? Should I trust the government? We'll be right back.
you think she's good enough?
I'm sorry, I have to fade this.
No, I love how Roger Waters there.
Me?
His voice just sort of fades, just so. I know what I'm doing tonight. I'm getting this, digging this baby out. I'm gonna go through all four sides. I'm so glad you brought this. We were geeking out while we were listening to it, how much we love this whole record. Mm-hmm. Their music just they just let everything breathe mm-hmm. so nicely. This is a good cut to show that.
Yeah, I like the singularity you keep pointing out in records. Like, I hear so many records that don't seem to know what they're about. You know what I mean? Or have so many ideas, none of them are heard.
Oh boy, you really nailed it with the problem with records today. You really nailed it. A lot of that is technology has mutated to the point to where you can lay down every idea that's in your head, which is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
You just dilute the idea. We were talking about Ghost Rider by Suicide, which I mentioned to you guys.
We should play that.
I think that's a perfect example of whoa, what a committed sound. I mean, that is what it is, and it's uncompromising, and there's nothing else happening, and it leaves it all to your imagination like a horror film. The best horror films are the ones that leave it all to your imagination, like The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby or something, you know? Nothing going on, man. Just there.
This is Ghost Rider by Suicide. We'll play just a little bit.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. Beep, 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 he's looking so cute. Sneaking round in a blue jumpsuit. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero.
I don't even think they were using a synth back then. When I saw them in the late 70s, I think it was an organ and a distortion of some kind of effect. I don't even know what
they
had.
You're hearing there, I believe, is just a old transistor organ, maybe a Farfisa, I'm not sure, and like a drum machine, like a Rhythm King.
Yeah.
And him singing through a tape echo, man, you know.
Alan Vega and Martin Rev. Yeah, I saw them perform this before I really knew their music, and this is the late 70s, and mine was blown. I mean, it was kind of like the closest thing you could connect to this music was rockabilly, right?
It's
barely
that.
But it's rockabilly without the guitar, without the drums, without the just...
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what it is. And this is a
but
band
But the
that,
singularity.
Yeah. This is a band that, you know, is very hip to reference in the studio. A lot of people will reference this band in the studio, and they're usually the bands that want to put 500 overdubs on their record. And, you know, like, I'm like, listen to Suicide. Listen to that band that you say you want to be like.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Does that kind of advice back and forth happen much? Like maybe at this stage of the game for you where you're working more with artists that have come to a place in their life where they maybe know more what they want. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen, or does it? I mean, you don't have to give names, but...
I work with people at all different levels of their career, you know. Really, honestly, I think that the thing that I try to do more than anything else is... Okay, Robert Fripp said something that I always think about.
And Robert Fripp, great guitar player.
Yes,
King Crimson is the band, if you don't know, you must...
He said that everything we truly are is revealed when we play. And I really believe that.
Wow, what does that say about him?
Well,
but
exactly.
It's true, right?
Exactly.
But he's a man of precision.
And so, like, maybe, possibly what my job as a producer is to help tear down those walls. tear down those walls and find out who you really are and exploit that 100%, you know? If you think about it, though, it's really true. You know, like young bands, usually they don't listen to one another and they are obnoxious in the way they play, which is exactly the way you are when you're 19. You know, you don't listen to anybody and you're obnoxious.
Yeah. First record you ever bought?
If I bought it, I don't remember, but definitely without a doubt, the first record that I listened to over and over and over again would have been the soundtrack to Walt Disney World, all the music from Walt Disney World. And specifically, one song was Grim Grinning Ghosts from The Haunted Mansion.
Always like the dark, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's definitely what I like. And maybe possibly this song is to blame for exactly that.
All right, let's
which
dig
is
deep.
Why I think it, you know, it's worth talking about. And everything about it.
We have a couch you can lay down. We'll have a long talk about this.
Remember to use I feel.
Right.
When you play this song.
This I song feel. Makes me feel dot, dot, dot. The vocals are done by Thurl Ravenscroft, who was the voice of Tony the Tiger in The Grinch.
The Grinch, yeah.
Yeah.
You're a mean one,
wow.
Mr. Grinch.
Didn't know you had in you, Mr. Hilton. There we go.
Dude, you and I should totally hang.
Here comes.
Crypt doors creak and the tombstones quake.
Gruesome mockers wane and wake.
Happy haunts materialize
and begin to vocalize.
Grim grinning ghosts about to socialize. Now don't close your eyes and don't try to hide.
Or a silly spook may sit by your side.
Shrouded in a dark disguise.
They pretend to terrorize.
Grim grinning ghosts come out to socialize. As the moon climbs high o'er the dead oak tree,
spooks arrive for the midnight spree.
Creepy creeps with eerie eyes
start to shriek
and harmonize. Grim grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
When you hear the knell of a requiem bell,
brutals dream where spirits dwell.
Restless bones etherealize.
Rise as spooks of every size.
When the crypt doors creak and the tombstones quake, spooks come out for a swinging wake. Happy thoughts materialize and begin to vocalize. Grim grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
Now don't close your eyes and don't try to hide. Or a silly spook may sit by your side. Shrouded in a daft disguise.
They pretend to terrorize. Grim grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
The moon climbs high over dead oak tree. Spooks arrive for the midnight spree. Creepy creeps with eerie eyes start to shriek and harmonize. Grim grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
When you hear the knell of a requiem bell, weird glows gleam where the spirits dwell. Restless bones etherealize. Rise as spooks of every size. Every last night day.
When the crypt doors creak and the tombstones quake.
So bizarre. What year are we thinking?
I believe it was 63.
So it was the early 60s. The effects and things that people all did with wonderful analog tape.
That's
and slowing
right.
things down and speeding
right.
things up was quite remarkable. Did you ever know Jim Kopp's stuff at all? Oh, okay. Well, he's another subject for another time, mm-hmm. but kid stuff, amazing things with analog tape. Mm-hmm. You should listen to some of his stuff. But tell me more about this record, The Grim Grinning Ghost. I know nothing about this. Robin, you obviously do.
Well, I certainly remember it from the ride, the Haunted Mansion
I'm
ride.
I'm afraid of rides.
there's a moment, actually, where when you're going through the ride where using some sort of hologram technology,
yes.
ghosts are sitting next to you
yes.
on your ride. And
Pepper's
I remember
Ghost.
The, yeah, and I remember this song playing mm-hmm. when I looked to my left or whatever it was and saw the
Hitchhiking
ghost.
Hitchhiking
Ghost. Yeah, the ghost yeah. sitting next to me. But you had we were talking while it was playing, and you had a great way of summing up what this is like comparing it to Tom Waits.
Yeah, I mean, this is Tom Waits before Tom Waits. But if you, like, the thing is when I was a kid, I was so attracted to this song, but I was scared of it. I was scared of it. The record would sit with my other records, and I would see it in there, and I would be like, do I have the bravery to listen to it right now? And sometimes I would, and I'd listen to it, and I was mesmerized by it. But then the thing is I grew up, and then I went back and listened to it, and I was like, this is brilliant. this is really, really well done. I've never in my entire life heard background vocals that sound as tight as that ever in my life. The harmonies are the tightest harmonies I've ever heard ever. And this was for a silly kid's ride, you know? But they were committed to making something special. Everything about that song is incredible to me. It has tubular bells, which is funny because we were listening to it and I had tubular bells in my song that we listened before. And hammered percussion, marimba. And the chord progression is actually quite chromatic and almost could be like, it could be modern classical. If you like broke the chords down, I think it's like an A to a B flat to a B, which is all really, you know, jagged and close together and clustered and not easy to listen to. I just think it's brilliant.
Did you listen to, Disney had another record too. It was from around that same time, the Chilling Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House. Yeah. My brother and I would put that on and it always began with the story, you are a bold and courageous person, afraid of nothing.
Here's another thing about that record that's really weird to me is the speakers are 180 degrees out of phase, the left and the right on that record.
Really? Wow. I would have played it. I guess I would have played it mono version.
You might have, but the stereo version are 180 degrees out of phase. The reason they did that, of course, was to make it sound extremely stereophonic. But as an engineer, somebody who spends your whole life listening for things to be out of phase, that record is totally painful to listen to.
Maddening.
Well, it sounds like it's coming from the back of your head when they do that, doesn't
Precisely.
It?
Precisely. Yeah.
Can you make a scary record anymore? Is there anything?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
you definitely. Do. Well, if you ever heard a band like Jesus Lizard, I think that they're very scary.
Tell me about them and let's play a song.
Well, the song Then Comes Dougley, which is the first song I ever heard by them, I think it's terrifying. It comes out with the rhythm section, just an unrelenting like beast, like just walking towards you, like knocking things over. And then the guitar comes in and the guitar almost sounds more like a Miles Davis horn line. It's completely like 12 tone. It never repeats a note. One of the amazing things that he's doing is he's actually playing a position on his guitar that makes it out of tune. And the only reason why you would ever do that is to make somebody completely unsettled. And that's an artistic choice. I mean, obviously, they wanted to scare you. And every time I hear that song, I feel the same thing. I'm like, nobody's going to be my boss, you know? That was probably one of the songs that made me want to record. And, of course, quick nerddom. It was recorded by Steve Albini.
And you worked under him, with him?
I do a lot of records at his studio, which is a tremendous studio. And Steve was very kind to me in my early days. And he still is, in my estimation, the best living engineer around. He still has a capability of getting sounds that unlike nobody else that I know.
Here's the Jesus Lizard, Then Comes Deadly.
going to guess your dad likes this.
Actually, you know what? I have always felt like this band was my ZZ Top.
Dear Jesus Lizard.
No, it's amazing rhythm section, untouchable rhythm section.
Texas really, band?
Yes. Really irreverent guitar player that when I listen to, the subtlety just blows my mind. Insane vocals.
Subtlety is not a word I would have picked up on. Now, when you say subtlety in something...
In the guitar playing, I absolutely hear subtlety because that doesn't sound complex, but trust me, as a guitar player, it truly is. It's good. Very, very hard to play what he's doing.
Awesome.
When you talk about Terrifying, this song, I think even the name of this song has so many implications. You know, it either means someone's coming for you, then comes Dudley, or this person named Dudley's next, like everyone else has gotten it and he's next. I mean, it's
creepy. It's on a level of perversion that you can't even put your finger on.
Yeah.
And I truly, truly love this band.
When I asked the question earlier, can you make a scary record, I wasn't thinking of a record you did work on this year, which is the Swans record.
Scary record.
Yeah. Let's play a little bit of the Swans. A Little God in My Hands is the song, and what's the album? To Be Kind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that the theremin again?
No, that's actually...
That's frightening.
It's just a keyboard. I believe it's an EMS keyboard is what it's called. Yeah.
Those are the old synths from the late 70s,
that's
early
right.
80s.
Yep.
With the ones with the little plugs? Is that the one with the little...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you have to patch
right,
the sounds
patch everything.
Yeah, the oscillators.
But at that moment, because I asked that one particular sound, but at that moment, there is so much going on.
Yeah, trust me, I know.
I'm wondering, a band like Swans, I'd say they're visionary and they have a vision. They're a band, two different things, but what I mean by the second part is that they're a band that knows their sound. They're a band what do they look for from you when they come to the studio?
Well, Michael Girard is a true artist in every way that I know how to measure an artist. Uncompromising, argumentative. You know, I mean, he knows what he wants. I'm a I'm just a vehicle for the vision with a band like that. And I really felt like I understood that band a lot. I'd been listening to them for years, watched their trajectory. And I respect Michael. I respect what he's trying to do. I respect that he doesn't care if people like him. We did that record in a way that Michael had always wanted to do a record, but had been told that he couldn't.
Meaning?
Well, for example, much to my chagrin, I recorded them all in the same room without headphones, and you can imagine the acoustical nightmare that must have been, because they're the loudest band ever, and they recorded even louder, if you can imagine that. And so imagine like having a drum kit about 6 feet away from the vocal mic.
For people who don't understand, who have never been in studios, who puzzle at the fact that you'll stick a drummer in another room. The reason, and you can expand on this, but the reason that happens is that it gives you, as the guy who's going to mix this stuff, a little control over bringing in certain instruments. So if you have the loud guitar also captured by the vocal mic, and you start to bring up the vocal mic, you're now bringing up the guitar as well.
That's
and
right.
Just so people get sort of picture of why engineers isolate instruments.
Precisely. It's a means to control things in a way that everybody is probably going to want when it comes to the mix.
But the reason that they want to play in one room is because there's this thing called playing music live you get, that things happen that are magic that don't happen when you isolate.
Precisely. And Michael wanted that, and I wanted to be able to give him that. I wanted to be the person that gave him that.
So you wanted to give him both things.
And of course, yes, it was extremely hard. It's extremely hard. And you do give up a lot of clarity and a lot of perfection in the sounds. But what you can gain when you're dealing with a band like the Swans, that's such a tremendous live band, what you gain is the X factor of those gentlemen playing in the room together, which, if you've ever seen them, we're talking about scary music. They're definitely scary. Scary music. And I wanted to somehow facilitate that coming across on the record. And as much as everyone seems to like the record, I think we did it.
Yeah, you sure did. You produced, I can't remember what show we did this year, Mr. Hilton, but we did a show, and there were at least two songs that John produced, which is how we decided say, let's get in touch with this guy. I think one of them was Angel Olsen.
Right.
I'm going to guess it is. There's a lot of different sounds on Angel's record that came out earlier at the top of the year. And let's play the rocker, because I'm curious what this was not quite the character you think of when you think of Angel Olsen. And I'm wondering how this song Forgiven/Forgot came to be.
Fun to listen to this stuff.
I bet.
I don't sit around and listen to this stuff after I'm done normally, you know.
It's killer.
What's it like hearing this again for the first time, probably? I don't know.
It reminds me of a couple of things that I did on that song, actually, that I think were the right calls. But
And I see your eyes gleaming when you say it. What did it make you think of?
Well, technically, there's something that's actually really wrong about that mix, technically. But I remember making that decision, and I'm really glad I did that, even though most people go, that's wrong.
Is that in the vocals, the filtering
of
the vocals?
No. Well, yeah, sure, you could say that. There's just so many things wrong with it. No, what it is the song starts, right? And normally your big bassy thing would be your bass drum. Mm-hmm. But what I chose there mix-wise, and I kind of think it makes the song really work, is when the chorus comes in, the loudest thing is the floor tom. And it's really wrong, yeah. Mixing-wise, that's really wrong. But like, I did that because I wanted to make that chorus sound really absurd. And I really think it works. And it's nice to hear it back. And it really makes me excited to, like, because that technically is sort of wrong in the same way that there's a lot of things wrong with, I don't know, the old Stooges records, you know? They're mixed like cartoons, which are always my favorite sounding records, you know? They're mixed absurdly, you know? And that's sort of, that was my take on a Stooges mix there, I think, right there. But it's funny that you mentioned the vocal thing, though, and I can tell you where all that, the vocal sound on that record came from, was strictly because Angel, who first of all I think is brilliant and is going to make a huge scar on in music in the coming years. I think she's so great. She was very, very concerned about making a record that was too slick, like very worried about it. And I ended up working with her by recommendation of her label.
Jag Jaguar.
Which is one of the best labels around. I think that she was really worried by the idea of like a producer like, you know, like she just pictured some guy with like a hairy chest and gold chains, you know, sitting on the couch eating.
All right, baby, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I'm going to make you a star. So what I found that as long as I gave a roughness to her vocals, everything else she kind of accepted. And so one of the funny little tidbits about that record is there's not a single song on that record that's recorded with a microphone that costs more than $150.
Yeah, it has it's a little thinner and it's a little buried, right. And it's a little distorted.
Mm-hmm. Extremely.
Which is exactly the thing that focusing on getting the vocals perfectly captured would be the first thing that anyone might want to think to do, right? I mean, her voice is so remarkable. Mm-hmm. It is like, why wouldn't you? But it's like when you watch TV and you're watching an interview and the person being interviewed starts to break down and cry and the camera starts to zoom slowly in. It's exactly that problem, right? Yeah, yeah. You already have the emotion. You don't need to focus more on it. In fact, the more you focus on it, the worse. And for
exactly. Yeah. Don't overdo it.
Right. It's
don't
there.
Overdo it. Yeah.
It's very cool.
We could sit here and talk all afternoon. We have so enjoyed having
you. We're running out of tape.
We're running out of digital space on our hard drive. But before we let you go, I want you to settle a debate that Bob and I have had. We were talking about it earlier today, but we've talked about it a lot over the years. And that is my question of, can a really great producer take a very average musician and make them great?
Oh, boy.
By the way, I've got money on this.
Yeah.
I got money on your answer.
My theory is...
On your answer, not truth. Okay, whatever well, I the won't truth even... is, I don't even know, but on your answer.
Well, I have a somewhat evasive answer, but I...
Yeah, I've got my money.
A great producer can make a marginal talent. He, she can bring out what's special about that marginal talent, because I truly believe that everybody has something to say. It could take a lot of work, but yes, I think so. I think a great producer can... It's all about understanding where somebody's coming from and what they want to communicate to the universe, because everybody has some... You know, as he's saying, everybody has one great book in them. I think that that's true. And I do think there are no bad ideas, just... Well, very few bad ideas, but just millions of failed visions.
I'd say I won that bet.
You did win that.
But just for the sake of discussion here, let's play an undeniably marginal...
Whoa.
Artist here.
Okay.
And
okay.
You just take a listen. You tell me, you know, like maybe some of the things you might do with this.
So funny, I'm crying. It's so sad I could laugh. Am I coming or going? The answer's yes, the answer's no, the answer's not yet.
Well, okay. That's right. Definitely enough.
I've lost one bet, right? And now you toss my music, calling it the marginal.
This is I'm punking Bob a little bit here. Yeah. This is Danger Painters, his band that he makes.
My friend Michael Barron and I make a record every year in the month of February. We take the month of February, no matter what, start with fresh ideas. February 1st, we are done mixing and everything artwork. February 28th. And I love doing it. I've done it 8 times now.
You picked the shortest month of the year.
That's right. Isn't that too? Anyway, so Robin's question.
Now, I'm reluctant to play this because now I feel like you're going to have to go back on what you said, that, no, okay, maybe a really great producer can't make marginal work better. But I agree. My assumption has always been that a really, you know, you take like a Daniel Lanois or you know Tucker Martine. There are so many wonderful producers, and I think that if you can, if you have someone who has some good ideas, who can carry a tune, they've written some great songs and have a good foundation, that you can do something with that.
I don't think they even have to carry a tune.
Mix, just you have so many tools at your disposal.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. No.
Yeah, please clarify that, because I know what you mean.
I mean is that I've been too impressed and too moved by things that were so incredibly imperfect that
that's the difference.
Yeah, that's the difference.
You're not trying to make imperfection perfect.
Oh, I'm not. I have no interest in perfection.
Right.
It's not interesting at all. Yeah. Yeah.
Fabulous. See, I thought the answer was going to be, if the meat wasn't, if there wasn't there, if the essence wasn't there, that you can't make something great. And maybe you're saying the same thing. Maybe we both win. I'm not trying to get my money back.
You can't spin this around.
I would like to talk about this a little bit,
because
more.
This is important, because I think you're right and I'm right here, and John's going to make it so that both of us
actually
come out even.
Believe it or not.
What you're saying is, if there's an essence there, you can do something with it and bring that essence to the fore. The original question was, can you take a marginal talent and make it great? That's different than, can you find the talent in someone and draw it out?
There's a big caveat to this conversation, by the way, and that is, the artist has to be willing to let that happen.
Okay.
Right.
Talent is a very vague thing. It truly is to me. Like, I think everybody has something that they can communicate, but whether or not they're open enough to let that happen, I mean, there's all kinds of things in the way of that. And so you're both right, and I'm not trying to be diplomatic about that, but you actually are both right, because it sort of just depends on the moment for that person and their life and whatnot, you know.
Well put.
I want to start a show called Extreme Music Makeover, and you'll be our first producer.
I can't wait.
Bringing people in. You take their song, you've got 2 days, turn it into a gem. Okay. Will you be our first producer if we start that show?
Depends on the artist.
Thank you.
It'll be Bob.
Well, forget it. No, I'll totally do that. Awesome. What was wrong with that? I liked what we just heard, actually. Cool.
Thanks, John Congleton.
You bet.
Really wonderful to meet you and have you here.
Thank you. It's a true honor.
Anything coming out we should look out for with your name on it for the rest of this year? The year's almost over.
Yeah, I just finished a record with a great young band on Fat Possum called The Districts. That's very, very good. Oh, yeah. And I just mixed some stuff with Earl Sweatshirt, who's tremendous, I think.
Yeah.
Very bizarro talent. And working on a record with another hip-hop guy named Astronautilus, who's very, very cool.
Say that name again?
Astronautilus. His time will come, trust me. Unknown Mortal Orchestra, just mixed with them. And a great new band called Mini Mansions that's on T-Bone Burnett's label. Lots of good stuff coming out.
How about your own record? Do you have a timeline for that? Your solo record?
I'm always writing music for me or for other people, but I do hope that I put a record out early next year sometime, and when I do, I will send it to you guys and we'll talk about it.
Definitely. We have another one of the songs that you're working on that you sent us, I'd love to go out on, called Temporary Custodian.
And it's not a complete final anything, right?
No.
This is just a...
This is world premiere.
World premiere.
World premiere work in progress.
Bam!
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
You bet. Producer, engineer, musician, John Congleton. I'm Bob Boylan, along with Robin Hilton for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered. This is what it's like. We'll not be saved. We went looking for the sublime. We find only the inane. This is what we are. And we will
if a tree falls in the woods, it doesn't matter.
Just let go. Just
what's
let
the
go.
Sound of one hand clapping? It doesn't matter.
Just let go. Just
was
let
it
go.
The chicken or the egg? It doesn't matter.
Just let go. Just let go.
What can you do when you do nothing? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Just let go. 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 Just let go.